Jamestown, Virginia proudly advertises itself as the first permanent English settlement in North America. It was founded in 1607 by the Virginia Company, a group of traders based in London who'd been granted the land by King James I. Jamestown now holds a central place in American folk memory, but frankly there was nothing in the early years of the colony to suggest that the English would do any better in North America than the Spanish or the French. Jamestown was built next to a swamp, which provided good defence against the Spanish, but not against malarial mosquitoes. Many settlers were vagrants and beggars from the streets of London who wouldn't do a stroke of work, so Jamestown was soon racked by disease and starvation. Captain John Smith, its founder, said the survivors kept going on
roots, herbs, acorns, walnuts, berries, now and then a little fish, even the very skins of our horses. Nay, so great was our famine that a savage we slew and bedded, the poorer sort took him up again and eat him. And so did divers one another, boiled and stewed with roots and herbs. And one amongst the rest did kill his wife, powdered her with salt, and had eaten part of her before it was known, for which he was executed as he well deserved. Now, whether she was better roasted, boiled, or carbonadoed on the grill, I know not. But of such a dish as powdered wife I never heard of.
Cannibalism was only a temporary expedient, but the Virginia Company was never a going concern. And in 1624, King James I converted Virginia from a private venture into a colony run by the Crown. Yet the company had set three all-important precedents that marked out this first English settlement from the French and Spanish experiments elsewhere in North America. The first was private ownership of land. To encourage migration to a now notorious death trap, the company started what was called a headright system. Anybody who paid his passage across the Atlantic received 50 acres of land in Virginia. And not surprisingly, settlers with private property proved much more enterprising than mere company employees. A second novelty was that the company created an assembly comprising the governor, his council, and a house of burgesses elected by local freemen. Voting was generally restricted to men owning at least 50 acres, so this was no democracy. But it was still a generous franchise by the standards of the England of the day. Private ownership of land and local self-government were both signs that Virginia was putting down English-style roots, rather than remaining an artificial royal outpost like New Mexico or New France. But the colony wouldn't have prospered without an economic rationale, and that was tobacco. Virginia tobacco proved massively profitable, selling in England for 5 to 10 times what it cost to produce. By the 1630s, another colony to the north, named Maryland after the wife of Charles I, joined in the tobacco boom. Labour was provided by a steady supply of migrants from England, mostly poor, unskilled young men who came as indentured servants, paying for their passage by contracting to work for a master for a period of years. In return, he agreed to provide them with food, clothing and shelter, plus a payoff at the end. The standard period for an indenture was 7 years, after which the freedman was able to practice his trade or work for wages. Either way, an ex-servant could accumulate the means to buy land of his own, at a time when such social climbing was rare in England. But many indentured servants didn't survive Virginia's harsh climate and rampant disease, while others were brutally treated by their masters. In 1649, a servant called Joseph Mulders swore testimony that his mistress had beaten her maid, Charity Darlin,
in the quartering house before the dresser, more like a dog than a Christian, and that at a certain time I felt her head, which was beaten as soft as a sponge in one place, and that as she was a-weeding, she complained and said her backbone, as she thought, was broken with beating, and that I did see the maid's arm naked, which was full of black and blue bruises and pinches, and her neck likewise.
So this was a tough life. And as wages rose in England after the civil wars, the supply of young men and women willing to migrate as indentured servants tailed off. yet mass labour remained vital to cultivate cash crops like tobacco in Virginia, and rice, the staple of Carolina, a new colony south of Virginia. So the planters made a fateful decision, turning from white servitude to black slavery. Population growth in Carolina was rapid. It was soon divided into separate colonies, north and south, and by 1740 slaves outnumbered free whites by 2-1 in South Carolina, making it the only English colony on mainland America with an African majority. As white servant labour became harder to obtain in Virginia and Maryland, the planters there also turned to black slavery to maintain their tobacco economy. And the condition of slaves got progressively worse. In the mid-17th century, slaves had legal rights. There are cases where they sued in the Virginia courts. Some blacks bought their freedom or were given it by generous masters. And free blacks who fulfilled the property qualification were able to vote in elections. But as black numbers increased, so the difference in rights between white servants and black slaves became stark. Black slavery, unlike white servitude, was usually a life sentence. Worse still, your children inherited it as well. In 1705, Virginia pulled together its customs and laws into a formal slave code.
No minister or person within this colony and dominion shall hereafter wittingly presume to marry a white man with a negro or a mulatto woman, or to marry a white woman with a negro or a mulatto man, upon pain of forfeiting and paying for every such marriage the sum of 10,000 pounds of tobacco. And if any slave resist his master, correcting such slave, and shall happen to be killed in such correction, the master shall be free and acquit of all punishment, as if such accident had never happened.
But these harsh laws didn't mean that Negro slaves were entirely passive victims. Here's an account of one of the most significant 18th century slave revolts at Stono Bridge near Charleston, South Carolina, in 1739, written soon afterwards by an unknown white man.
On the 9th day of September last, some Angola Negroes assembled to the number of 20, and one who was called Jemmy was their captain. They surprised a warehouse and took a pretty many small arms and powder which were there for sale.
Jemmy and his band of slaves set off south from Stono towards Florida, a Spanish colony only 50 miles away that promised freedom to fugitive slaves.
Several Negroes joined them, they calling out liberty, marched on with colors displayed and two drums beating, pursuing all the white people they met with and killing man, woman, and child when they could come up to them. They marched 10 miles and burnt all before them without opposition. But the militia being raised, the planters with great briskness pursued them, and when they came up, dismounting, charged them on foot. The Negroes were soon routed, and this is to be said to the honour of the Carolina planters, that notwithstanding the provocation they had received from so many murders, they did not torture one Negro, but only put them to an easy death.
The Stono Rebellion was a minor affair, costing in all about 60 lives, but it sent shockwaves across white South Carolina. According to a report written a couple of years later,
everyone that had any relation, any tie of nature, everyone that had a life to lose, were in the most sensible manner shocked at such danger hanging daily over their heads. With regret, we bewailed our peculiar case, that we could not enjoy the benefits of peace like the rest of mankind, and that our own industry should be the means of taking from us all the sweets of life, and of rendering us liable to the loss of our lives and fortunes.
That's a nice line in hypocrisy. What the writer called our own industry was made possible by the industry, the work, of black slaves. They too aspired to the sweets of life, savoured by their white masters. But the lucrative cash crops of the southern colonies couldn't be cultivated without forced labour, and insurrections like Stono convinced whites that blacks had to be held down to prevent racial anarchy. There was one notable attempt to develop a different pattern of race relations in the South. In 1732, some London merchants and philanthropists known as the Georgia Trustees received a royal charter for a new English colony. Georgia was to be a kind of public-private partnership, run by the trustees but mostly funded by British taxpayers. And one of its most striking features was a ban on slavery. The trustees saw their new colony as a safe haven for persecuted European Protestants and as a fresh start for the miserable wretches of England's cities. Georgia settlers were to be productive small farmers growing useful crops like hemp and flax. Serving in the local militia, they'd also act as a buffer for South Carolina against the threat from Spanish Florida. And there was to be no slavery in this model colony, because that would encourage whites to live lives of luxury and idleness. One of the propagandists for Georgia explained its underlying philosophy.
As experience has shown, the inconvenience of private persons possessing too large quantities of land in our colonies means the greatest part of it must lie uncultivated. The trustees will allot no more land than what can with ease be cultivated, and yet will afford a sufficient and handsome maintenance. Civil liberty is to be established there in its full extent, no appearance of slavery, by which means the people, being obliged to labor themselves for their support, will be, like the old Romans, more active and useful for defense of their government.
In this austere social experiment, other vices were also banned, including liquor and lawyers. But the colony was always short of labour, for which many settlers blamed the restrictive policies of the trustees. A petition signed by over 100 citizens of Savannah in 1738 criticised
the want of the use of Negroes, which, if granted, would both induce great numbers of white people to come here and also render us capable to subsist ourselves by raising provisions upon our lands until we could make some produce fit for export and in some measure balance our importation.
Gradually, the trustees lowered their standards. The bans on lawyers, liquor, and large landholdings were dropped, and after peace with Spain removed the security threat, public funds dried up. In 1751, the defeated trustees handed Georgia over to the crown. Within a few years, the colony had become a plantation society just like South Carolina, run by a wealthy, slave-owning elite. The rebel slaves at Stono Bridge rallied to the chant of liberty. The opponents of the Georgia trustees had their own slogan, liberty and property without restrictions. In other words, the liberty and prosperity of white people depended on owning black people as private property. By the mid-18th century, that had become the Southern way. And much of subsequent American history has been an attempt to escape from its consequences.